This episode of The A-Team is brought to you by FaceToFaceGames.com, Canada's number one source for Magic the Gathering card singles.
You start with like the aggressive decks, where I was always a very proactive player because I always wanted to force my opponent. I just wanted to ask them constantly, do you have it? Do you have it? Oh, you do? Okay. Do you have it?
Welcome to the A-Team Podcast, brought to your ears by ManaDeprived.com, home of Canadian Magic.
In 2010, a crack Magic playing unit was sent to prison by the DCI Court for mises they didn't commit. These men promptly escaped from a federal pound-me-in-the-ass prison to the Canadian underground. Today, still wanted by Wizards of the Coast, they survive as podcasters of fortune. If you have a problem, if no one else can help, and if you can find them, maybe you can listen to The A-Team.
KYT.
Anything that costs a shit ton of mana, you're just like, bang! And they're like, fuck.
How does that go?
Bang! Fuck.
Jay Boosh.
And that's like the hyper angle. I never want to play in another GP again. I never, ever want to play in another GP.
And Jeremy.
And you're the reason I play Magic today. I'm like, I die. I was like just melting on the inside like that. I have inspired this kid to play Magic.
And now, the A-Team.
Hey everyone, welcome to episode 258 of the A-Team Podcast. This is KYT, all by myself, though not really. I've got Matthew, the content Mendoza, to save the day. How's it going, Matt? Whoa. Coming in with some swagger here.
Yeah, yeah. How's it going, everybody?
By everybody, you mean just me, right?
Oh, sure, sure.
Jay, still stuck in school, and Jeremy is, I don't know if he mentioned it on the air, but they moved him at work. They moved him higher north. Higher north, that means the same thing. I mean, they moved him up north somewhere, and apparently they messed with the schedule, and we don't know what his future is going to be, what the future of the A-Team is going to be like in terms of when it's going to need to record to accommodate him, or if we could accommodate him. But we got Mr. Mendoza, and I got a lot of people who love you, so thanks for coming on again.
Thank you.
I do want to do a quick thing. I never really plug my Patreon, so I'll do it for this one. Patreon.com/KYT Magic. Right now, everyone who's a patron is really supporting the ManaDeprived.com podcast network. The network cost me roughly $200 US to run, and right now the Patreon has been roughly around $100 a month. I pay the other half, let's just say, but any amount, $1 per listener, has been a huge help in maintaining the podcast network, which is a lot more expensive than I originally thought. But
yeah, whoa, $100 a month.
But thanks to everyone for supporting the network. So moving on, we got Mr. Mendoza here, and who's been into coverage, working with coverage, official Wizards coverage. And now there was an announcement by Hélène Bergeau today that I felt like the initial Twitter reaction to me was people were confused about what it actually meant. And I came away sort of like, is there that many changes in it? Like, you run it down for me, Matt?
I can try my best. I really don't know much more than what has been put out there by Hélène. What it looks like to me is that they are looking to go in a direction that really focuses on set releases. Hélène said that in the article, and it's pretty apparent, pretty obvious if you read it. But more to the point, the idea of pre-recorded or recorded and then posted after the fact coverage has been actually bandied about for a while. So I'm not surprised that they're going to try it. How it's going to look, I don't know. I think it's an interesting approach. It's a little disappointing because it may mean more gigs for the coverage crew, which, you know, we get paid to do that stuff and we enjoy the perks and we like hanging out with each other. So when we like traveling and we like seeing all our friends and going to all these cool places, but so that may be a thing that happens a little bit less, but you know, we'll be all right. But we haven't heard exactly how coverage at the events where they do recorded and posted after video, we don't know how those are going to work. I'm sure we'll find out in the next, you know, week or so. But it's outside of like what Helene announced, we're not sure. My initial impressions, I'm concerned. I'm obviously concerned. My two biggest concerns really are giving up market share in terms of coverage to other tournament series that may come in to fill the void, which I'm kind of bummed. I always think, you know, more is better, especially when you have like such tight point races, like what we saw with like Pascal and Alex. And like, that's always really intriguing and really engaging, but I don't know. There, it could be that those player narratives are communicated just as effectively with this abbreviated coverage schedule. My biggest concern is that one of the decisions that they made was to, when there are multiple GPs on multiple continents on the same weekend, if you look at the schedule, the master schedule, they actually synced up the formats. So for example, I think in January or February, there's a weekend with three different modern GPs on three different continents. The biggest change is that one of the biggest changes is that they have chosen to, instead of doing 2 to 3 GPs worth of coverage on that weekend, they're only going to be covering one GP and then doing text at the other ones, which is kind of a bummer because I loved those weekends for the fact that you could feasibly, like at Chiba, like for example, in Modern Masters weekend, you could tune in like Friday and basically be watching 24 hours worth of like you could watch coverage, live coverage nonstop the whole weekend.
Right, right.
And I thought that was pretty cool. And I think that's a pretty cool thing to do. I also, I'm looking at like, so for example, on June, they're going to cover Grand Prix Columbus or Prague. Now, one of those time zones is very different from the other one. So, you know, to accommodate viewers, they're going to have to change, like viewers are going to have to settle, you know, North American viewers are going to have to settle for getting up later or something like that. They're basically just having to adjust to a different time zone. Or the same thing could be said for European listeners if they chose, or European viewers if they chose to cover Columbus. It's an interesting, you know, it's an interesting time for tournament magic because we saw like a crazy growth the last 2 years, and now we're starting to see this. You know, we saw expansion, and now we're kind of going into a period of contraction and refinement. So I don't know. I'm curious what it's going to be. I'm curious about what the plans are for the video coverage that won't be live streamed. That could be interesting. It could be what people have been asking for. It could be that people didn't really respond to the stream as much as I mean, what I've heard is that a lot of people, they get a lot of viewers who watch coverage archives after the fact, which makes a lot of sense because a lot of people do stuff over the weekends. Like I'm usually busy over the weekends doing something. So for me to catch coverage is usually actually kind of a special thing.
So did they really do it so that when there's two GPs, like the assumption is when there's two GPs at the same time, they just want like all the viewers to look at one, and any casual, I guess maybe random Twitch guy will just be like, we'll just see one and not be confused by multiple Magic feeds. I'm not
correct.
Is that
I don't know if it's to prevent confusion or what, but I know that they doubled down on, you know, they basically said, okay, so all the GPs on a particular weekend are going to be the same format, so that we can have our choice of which event we want to show.
Oh, okay. So it's not so the viewer can't say like, I want to see that other format this weekend.
Correct.
Since they're the same format, it's yeah, but I came away with the same feeling as you. Basically the whole, I'm just not sure.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It just left a lot to be, you know, known. It was very, so I don't know whether this is positive or negative yet, but what I am excited about is that, I don't know where I read this, maybe on Twitter, that they were going to announce perhaps a new lineup or a tweak coverage lineup. I don't know where I read this. So that's something I'm really curious about, and I'm not sure when they're going to announce the official new or guys that will be the officially part of the coverage. Perhaps a few surprises. I mean, perhaps some of the pros who've had a bit of time in the booth, and now they might even prefer that than playing. I don't know, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I had heard that, you know, there's been a clamoring for hiring a female commentator to represent that demographic, and I'm all for it. I've heard that Gabby Spartz did fairly well at the one of the latest TCG player events, so that could, you know, she could be a very good option. I didn't watch that event, so I can't really speak to it, but everybody told me that she did a fairly good job. So yeah, I mean, that could be a change in the lineup. I'm not sure. I mean, doing coverage is an interesting proposition, because it's one of those, do you want to sit on the sideline and take the safe money, or do you want to ride the white pony and go, you know, get your fix and have fun and gamble a little bit, you know?
Yeah, but then there are those people who just want that little exposure, and they feel like they might need to play and compete to get there. But then you could just be like one of the main coverage stars, and I think for people like I guess like Kenji, and it would be a tough decision, because I know he really wants to make the PT really badly, but also be on coverage has been really great for him overall. So he's one of those guys with those tough decisions. If he is one of those people that have to make, is put into a position where he has to make that choice. So I like, personally, I don't know what I would do at this point in my career if I was somehow offered a spot, because I've sort of slowed things down, because I don't have, my Pro Tour aspirations aren't as strong as they used to be. Uh-huh. But there's definitely a potential rekindling this weekend, once I start watching the coverage for the World Magic Cup, as I see my friends Sean McLaren, Alexander Hain, and Justin Richardson fight against your country for World Magic dominance. And that's going to rekindle a bit of my fire, I'm sure, to try to make the team next year. So
USA, USA, USA.
It's the A team, buddy. but the USA, what's interesting, let's just transition to the World Magic Cup here. A lot of people are coming up with these power rankings, even pros, and the USA team, very strong. And I'm seeing rankings where they have Japan, USA and Canada. A lot of people have all of these countries in their top five. So I'm expecting good things, though Canada has never done well. And the excuse has always been lack of teamwork, even though we've had the fire, the name power, if you will. But we've always had the reputation of not having great teamwork, and some attribute it to maybe the fact that our country is so big and that people don't live close enough to each other to have any sort of chemistry. And Sean McLaren's always known as the lone wolf of the Pro Tour. So there's a lot of people who are skeptical about our odds of doing well, and I can totally understand why. It's possible that there's just not enough team chemistry, and that would probably be looked at as one of the reasons we yet again failed to make top four. But you guys have a sweet team. You have Tom Martel.
Okay.
You have Neil Oliver, and you have another superstar that just escapes my mind right now.
I'm actually looking that up right now.
I'm an idiot. Mike Sigrist, who's the captain. And so these three sickos, and then you have a fourth that I've heard was decent, but those three alone is people are going to be hard pressed to match up to them. So, I mean, I'm really looking forward to this weekend. It's one of those awkward things also for the team thing where I think you have to pick three people to do constructed and then three people to do limited. And, you know, one of the guys who for teams like Canada and other teams where it's sort of obvious who's going to be the odd man out, like you're unlikely to ever have like Sean McLaren, Pro Tour champion, Alexander Hain, Pro Tour champion, sit on the sidelines of either constructive limited. Yeah. But for other countries, when you have four guys who maybe are a little closer in strength, I wonder, you know, ultimately what happens and who decides. But I guess the captain must ultimately decide.
I mean, I think you go with whoever has the format figured out the most, right?
Right. Some of these people, like, they might not know each other very well, and it's hard to tell when they're coming together to meet. Like, Justin Richardson actually left the country roughly a week ago to meet earlier in Barcelona with the other guys. I heard Sean McLaren came a bit later, but the other countries, maybe they just like, hey, let's just chat a bit online and meet up, like maybe just days or the day before the start of the tournament. So that's interesting to me.
Yeah.
It's like, if I was on the team, I would want that extra time, but then you have other people with, you know, other commitments. So it's a lot of challenges ahead, but I'm very excited for this event.
You know what I'm really stoked about?
What?
A team unified constructed.
Okay.
I don't know if you ever, people who know me pretty well have heard just story after story from the team trios, the one team trios constructed PTQ season that they did back when it was Time Spiral, or it was Kamigawa Ravnica Standard. I tell people all the time, that format was stupid fun. Like, when you have, I want them, it's a logistical problem. I'll give them that. But to have a team trios season was incredible. Like, you just get to like build decks with your teammates, and then you get to go to different events, and you basically get to develop as a team. And it's I wish they did more team series events. Like, that would be awesome. But yeah, you know unified deck construction, right?
Right, right.
Yeah. So basically, for those who don't, it's that if you put all three team members' decks on one deck list, it has to be a standard legal deck. So you have only one player can use the four Bloodstained Mires, and only one player can use four Windswept Heaths and stuff. So it actually creates like an interesting sub meta game where you're basically going, okay, so which team is going to have what deck at what seat with what player? Do you put your aggro deck in the middle, or do you put your aggro deck like with your worst player against their second best player? Do you give, you know, like, oh, it's just all these metagaming decisions that you have to make, in addition to like figuring out the format of like what you can play, you know, like, you know, back in the day, we went with a configuration that was white black control blue-green combo and then red Naya Zoo. And but other teams went with like a red-green deck, a black-white deck, and then another deck because some of the other cards were being used. So I don't know. It's just Team Trios is always a format that's excited me.
I think I'm interested to see what happens just because so many of the different wedges like Abzan and Jeskai and even the shards like Esper are playable, that it presents a challenge. Whereas in other formats, like let's say if you did it in Unify constructed in the Devotion days, like you could just have a guy playing mono black Devotion, one guy playing mono blue. So you don't have that problem when the last guy can play red or whatever, or red green. But here, it's an interesting challenge, though, even though the different decks span multiple colors and share colors, a lot of the key cards are really different. Like an Abzan deck doesn't really share a lot of cards with even an Esper deck. Like even though they're both white black, it's not like.
Well, who's going to play the Murderous Cuts? Who's going to play the Ultimate Prices? Who's going to play that stuff? Like, you still have small decisions to make even there. Yeah, I do see, like, there are obvious choices, but...
Yeah, there are obvious choices. And like, you bring up even cards like Murderous Cut, the fact that these decks don't tend to play four anyways, mean that some of them can just split, like, two... A lot of times, like, even my deck, I've played decks where it's like a 1-1 split sideboard, so I only need two in my Abzan deck, and then the Esper guy can have two, right?
Yeah.
So I'm interesting to see, especially what my quote in quotes my team comes up with, what your team comes up with, because I hope Canada does better than the U.S. Of course.
I mean, what would be your three decks? I mean, I think off the top of my head, I would probably go with Atarka Red.
For sure, that's one of the easier ones.
Yeah, I think. Abzan that has to be there. I mean, Abzan and like some sort of blue black or like Esper Dragons or something like that. I mean, that's like the easiest configuration I can think of. You have to split your Den Protector somehow.
Yeah, I agree with that. Or you have like, because the problem with like having the Rally deck is the Rally deck needs
every land in the format.
Yeah. Yeah, so it needs the four Windseth Heaths, it needs the four Flooded Strands, it needs like four Jaces, so that deck probably won't work. I mean, you can have that plus mono Atarka Red, but then what the heck's your third deck that doesn't need that land base, you're right. So
yeah, that's going to be, I'm super interested now, because that was kind of the conundrum we approached the PTQ format that we played in, was that I chose to play Naya Zoo just because like other teams were going with like this red green aggro deck called Heezy Street, made popular by Mark Herberholtz, and because it was the safe aggro choice that used the least amount of resources. But my philosophy was like, I like my teammates were comfortable playing other decks, like non-aggressive decks, so I was like, I'm gonna play Naya guys because it's the strongest deck in the format, and I wonder if Rally could be that deck in that format, where it's the most resource intensive, but it also rewards you for making that sacrifice.
Mm-hmm. Right. Actually, there's one deck that's sort of unique in its own right that plays its own set of cards, which is the red green ramp deck, the Eldrazi deck, right?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Playing explosive vegetation and all that good stuff. So that gives you a lot of potential flexibility. You have these set of cards that no other deck is really playing, like Ugin's and stuff. So it's going to be interesting, man. Now, before we bring our guest, Mr. Adam Yurchik, who just recently won the biggest, I think it's the biggest TCG player tournament every year. It's the Max Point Series Championship. I didn't want to touch on the fact that our last MDSS Montreal 2 took place last Saturday, this past Saturday, and a regular at the store, Primo Capriolo Morris won with Abzan Doran. Like, it's just an Abzan deck, but it features Doran and has main deck Spellskites and other, only plays two Siege Rhinos, but it's just playing main deck Spellskites to obviously take advantage of the Doran effect. And he was able to take it down, and he also beat a fellow Abzan player. The other guy was playing a more standard list, and I was watching their games, and it was interesting for me to watch a bit of the top eight. And I didn't know how. I wasn't sure if you know, I had some, let's say, what moments when I was watching okay. the finals.
Like good or bad?
Because I wasn't so sure, because I hadn't played the format in so long. So in like the top eight, people would generally, a few of the mistakes that I would see is when they have Liliana in, let's say, a mirror match, they would plus one. I feel it's an autopilot move to discard Lingering Souls, because you feel like you can discard that card but get extra value from it later. So it's like a card that you can, you feel like you can discard without loss. Though having four tokens is a bigger deal than having two. And in the mirror, you sort of, usually you tend to discard the discard spells. Those are the ones that you don't really love, mm-hmm. Like Inquisition of Kozilek. So the way I would play is basically plus one and basically discard my discard spells and just keep my action spells like Lingering Souls and things like that. And I also, like a lot of the Abzan matches I watched, I felt people, when they had, somehow when they had Elspeth, they were trading a lot more than I would. Whereas I would just make three guys, instead of like trading with a Kitchen Finx, blocking with two guys and them gaining two life, bringing back a Sphinx, a 2-1 Sphinx, I would probably just chump with one if I have Lingering Souls tokens to race them in the air. So I'd make three, chump block with one token, keep making three soldier. Like I will always get two extra soldiers out of the equation. So, you know, I was a bit perplexed by the moves. Like I could be totally off, but it just felt like a lot of games historically when I played Elspeth, I just chump block and just like can crash in with my clock them with my flyer and keep the clock going. And I feel like sometimes you waste too much time and resources by like lining up. At one point, the Doran was a with the help of the two Noble Hierarchs that the player had seven toughness, right?
Uh-huh.
And the opponent, well, he miscalculated. I guess he didn't see he didn't realize the exalted triggers because he blocked with six Elspeth tokens. I get playing around one removal spell, right? So that it could still kill the Doran if it was like 05, but it's seven toughness. So, but even then, why don't you just block the Doran? It's not like there's anything that I know of that gives the Doran like trample or anything crazy. So I would just chump block with it, keep my five other tokens on my turn, plus one, make another three. And eventually you can just ultimate Elspeth and kill them, or you just have too many tokens where it's an awkward proposition for them to attack with a Doran when you can block with one and crack back with seven or eight tokens.
Yeah.
And they just have like two Noble Hierarchs. So I don't know if it was just, so the way I was watching, I was just like, yeah, I'm not too sure, but I haven't played Modern in a while. So maybe there's like a specific sideboard card that Fate makes you want to trade more. But ultimately, all that to say that Modern is a sweet event because we had 157 players, which is actually crazy for a Canadian non-PTQ event. I mean, before, like, we would usually crack, for even a PTQ, 100, we're talking 120-ish type numbers. So people around the country and the U.S., like, SCG is trying to favor Modern over other formats more. Modern is just a huge hit, no matter where you go.
And, yeah.
It's undeniable. It's undeniable. So I think you can safely invest in your Modern deck. Like, keep playing Affinity, Matt, and people love it. There's always going to be tournaments, it seems.
Are we bot bros?
Yeah, we are for now, until I master Amulet Blue.
Okay.
Now we're going to call up the Zen Master, Mr. Amurchik. Let's see how it goes. So, congratulations, Adam. I'm ecstatic that you are the TCG player max point the 2015 champion or whatever.
Thank you.
Yes, congrats.
To my knowledge, it's their big tournament of the year, right?
Correct. In the summer, there was an invitational for the first time, and that was a smaller field. They invited some people who won qualifiers or top eighted Grand Prix or Pro Tours, but this tournament was the culmination of the Max Point series, which is essentially their series that goes throughout the country and has events all over and gives out points, which people use for this tournament. So yeah, this is the one that's been going on for a number of years now, 4 or so years, and is definitely their high profile event. So it was very exciting to take it down after riding there for 5 years almost.
I'm super happy for you. I think that this tournament eventually, like the SCG series, might be a tournament that Wizards will give a Pro Tour slot at the end for, maybe possibly even as early as next year if they keep doing it.
Yeah,
because it's one of those.
I never.
Yeah, it's one of those. Yeah, it's one of those high profile tournaments. But for you, like, it was a huge surprise because I didn't see that you had won until like maybe like the Facebook statuses started popping up, or I just saw your face on tcgplayer.com with a trophy. Because it's been a while since, like, you took a sort, I wouldn't say a break, maybe sort of, but then you were named for a while one of the best GP players to never have a PT top eight or whatever, and then, like, you sort of tried to grind here and there, and now you just, like, boom, win this tournament. So tell me, like, am I accurate, or in terms of how dedicated you've been in the last few years, has it been on and off?
Yeah, I played my last Pro Tour in Montreal gate crash the beginning of 2012. I was a level 6 pro, sort of equivalent of like a gold, kind of between a gold and a platinum pro in 2010, and then 2011 I was a gold pro, and then I took a step away from the game for a little while, didn't travel as much, was playing a little bit more locally at a new store that opened up near me.
Why did you choose to step away?
I stepped away because of personal reasons, okay, to develop myself more.
I definitely know how that is.
But even though you took like a break, you kept writing like every week almost, right?
Yeah, I was still writing and still playing the game, still involved with it, following it in the community somewhat. And then I also sort of focusing on improving my game and playing my A game and just thinking about the game on a different level. And I feel like I've come back with a renewed perspective and definitely a drive to not necessarily, the goal isn't necessarily to win. The goal is to just play my best and keep improving.
Wow. I love that mentality. Even though, like, we always reference when we chat, we've referenced that Jerry article where he thinks, where he writes you as like this stone cold motherfucking killer. It's always good to see you succeed, and now with this, like, I can't wait till you get back, because I think people, like, some of the more let's say recent players that have achieved some success, or some of the newer players just don't know how good Adam Jurcik is. So I can't wait for you to show them how good you are, man.
Thank you. Yeah, I had a lot of fun last weekend, and I've been playing a lot of GPs this year. I think I played 10 GPs. I think Pittsburgh was my 9th or 10th GP, and I had a bunch of day 2s. I actually had some a couple of close finishes. Back in Miami, I started out 9-0 with that green-white deck. And Toronto Standard, I put up a deep run. And then over the summer, I had some nice limited tournaments. I played two GPs sort of as like a pre-release. Madison was my pre-release, and I day two'd that. And I played the team GP back in Detroit with Dan Jordan and Ben Lucas, and we day two'd that and put up a deep run. That was a lot of fun. And I've been playing with some of the great players in the game.
Mm.
So it's definitely been a lot of fun.
Well, I'm expecting a huge comeback. So how did you prepare for this particular tournament, and why Abzan aggro? I noticed it's very, at least the main deck is very similar to what I played in a recent GPT at my local store, where I decided to net deck a Manguchi list. How did you, from a Channel Fireball article, so how did you prepare and how did you come up with this particular 75?
Okay, so looking back at it recently, Manguchi's article was actually instrumental in my deck list and my sideboard plans. I actually hadn't read the article until Friday. The guy I drove to the tournament with, Will Wingler, told me about this article. I read it, and it helped solidify some of the thoughts that I had on card choices and sideboard plans. So the fact that you took that from that article means you have a pretty good grasp of the deck. And then I also looked a lot on Magic Online lists. That's where you see like those two Rising Miasmas in my deck. Those come from Magic Online. I actually never tested them, and I never drew them in the tournament. And moving forward, I'm going to play Surge of Righteousness there for anyone who's keeping up to date. And then in the long term, I arrived at this deck just from playing the same Abzan Cons cards from the last year, playing Abzan aggro since the set came out. So it's basically been building off that and the knowledge I've gained.
So I guess you came to the same conclusions, where like the reason the Manguchi article resonated with me was that, you know, he replaced Hangerback Walkers, which I felt were just less and less good over time.
Yeah, one thing that sold me on that, because I liked Hangerback Walker, I liked it against red decks, I liked it against Esper, you know, against Faltung.
Right.
But there's a couple things. One, it's not aggressive, as anyone who's played with it knows. It's not attacking for a lot of damage. And then also, when you see Esper lists with Silk Wrap, it makes you wonder why you want to even have Hangerback Walker.
Yeah. I did want to ask you about the Rising Miasmas, but you answered it. It's like the one card I actually had to look up. And
yeah, I had to pay $1 for him on the site.
I mean, is it an extra anti Atarka red, like the Hordling Outburst version that it's looking to be good against, and ban tokens, I guess?
Yeah, it's against the red decks. Like, they have two ways to beat you: either pumping up creatures, doing a combo, or going wide. And I figured that Rising Miasma can, you know, be a 2-for-1 or 3-for-1, and because they're so reliant on creatures, it could set them back and give me time to win. I think in practice it's probably a little bit too slow, and they can also sort of counteract it with Atarka's Command, and it's probably better to have a more efficient threat or a more efficient card to answer their threat, like Surge of Righteousness or Ultimate Price, or a Ration Cleric could be decent, but it's kind of a poor blocker. So I think Pinpoint Removal is the way to go. You could also, in theory, splash Radiant Flames.
Whoa. Yeah. that's interesting. I actually have no clue. You mentioned like Surge of Righteousness. I don't know if green, red, like Atarka Landfall has fallen out of favor or not, because I don't really see it in the top 16, but obviously that's less good against a green they're green creatures, but then you have your ultimate price and your Murr's cut that can take care of the green guys, and then you save the white like surge for the red guys, right?
Yeah, I think that both points are true. The deck has fallen, and they do have targets. They still play Swift Spear. They still play Slide Runner, or actually they do play Slide Runner, whereas the other one doesn't. So it's still gonna be a good card.
So was it just smooth sailing for you in the Swiss rounds?
Yeah, so another reason that I played Abzan is, based on data that I've seen, basically Abzan Aggro is favored against every deck. Every deck in the field, other than five color Bring to Light, it's favored against, according to MTG Pulse, which I never knew about. My friend showed it to me, and I said, whoa, this is really surprising. I didn't know this data was out there. It says that Abzan Aggro is favored, so why would I not play this deck? It's also the deck I'm most comfortable with, so I spent the week testing basically every other deck in the format on Magic Online, playing leagues with the red deck, all kinds of Esper decks. I was trying to make a Sky Spawner deck work.
Wow.
Yeah, and it was good. I was very close to playing it. I actually unsleeved Abzan Aggro and put this Esper deck together.
What else is in this crazy deck?
Yeah, I'm super curious about this too.
It's like four Jace, and then I was playing around with Knight of the White Orchid and Ojitai's Command, but I think the best way is just do Hangerback Walker as a 2-drop, and then you play four Sky Spawner, and you play four Wingmate Rock, and then the rest of the deck is just token stuff like Gideon.
Hmm.
So it's kind of an Esper tokens list.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is.
Okay.
There's been some lists on Magic Online and like a guy top 16 GP Kobe with similar lists. It's an idea that's out there, and actually some people played the deck at the tournament and did all right.
I mean, what does Sky Spawner do for you that like whatever is normally played in its place doesn't?
Well, Sky Spawner does two things. One, it's a 2/1 flyer to trigger a raid. And then two, it's mana acceleration, so you can cast Wingmate on turn 4.
Oh, okay. That makes sense.
Yeah. And then another idea is actually to just do that in Abzan deck with Catacomb Sifter. And my friend Will played that deck at the TCG event. He played with 4 Catacomb Sifter and 4 Wingmate Rock.
Okay.
And he, in the end, he missed Anaphens of the Foremost too much, so his deck didn't really work out, but it's an idea out there. And I think that we'll see the Sky Spawner list around.
I think Anaphenza in Abzan seems more important than the Catacombs Sifter tricks.
Yeah, but it is. It is. And then actually at the TCG event, Rally was everywhere, so it was especially important. I think that if you did the Sifter Wingmate Rock deck, it would probably have to be a different archetype. With different cards focused on something else to take better advantage of both of those cards. Will was also talking about maybe a Sultai deck, play the Sifter and the Sky Spawner, and then accelerate into some Sultai threat.
He was going real deep on these. I mean, is he trying? So he's trying the Catacombs Sifter blue creature deck?
Yeah. It's a DC, Jace, who knows?
Oh, that is awesome.
In the end, it's all worse than Warden of the First Tree.
Yeah. I commented a couple weeks ago that Warden seems like the test for the format, really. Where you have to, you know, I saw it go from... Because right after the PT, it wasn't huge, and then it was like two weeks after the PT...
It exploded.
Yeah. It basically was just like everybody was attacking for 3 on turn 2 with their wardens.
Yeah, green-white Megamorph was a thing. That deck sort of died off since then.
Yeah. So how many rounds was the Swiss?
So it was 12 rounds of Swiss, 2 buys. So I played 10 rounds, which over two days was very reasonable.
I mean, I played 10 rounds in a day.
So. Yeah, it was like 250 people or something. And KYTS, was it smooth sailing? And yeah, it was. I I started out against Wesco in round three in a feature match, so it was definitely not smooth. But he basically didn't play a match. Game one, he got mana screwed. Game three, he got mana screwed. And I won. And that sort of set the tone for the tournament.
Gotcha.
Which is good for me.
Okay. And how was the top eight?
The top eight, well, the top eight was great. Pretty smooth. I did make a bunch of mistakes. I was pretty fatigued. But everyone else did for the most part as well. So it was fine. My deck was just so powerful that it bailed me out. And my draws worked out well. There was definitely some scary situations where I needed to hit lands. And I did. And I got there.
Did you squeak into top eight? How many losses did you have ultimately have in this after the Swiss?
So yeah, I started out 6-0.
Whoa.
And then I took a loss in the last round of day one. And then day two, I started out 4-0 and then got a draw in the last round. So it was just one loss all tournament.
What a boss. In my GPT, I basically also sort of ran the table. It wasn't like a big GPT at all. Mm-hmm. It was just 12 people. But John Stern, my good friend John Stern, was also playing. And I wanted to bring this up because he was playing Four Color Rally.
Yes.
And judging from, like, the judge was a friend of ours and was a part of the community, he felt like, you know, he knew me and John's like, okay, this is like the weirdest GPT ever to have like KYT and John Stern be part of it. And ultimately I did face John in the top four, and I wanted to pick your brain because that's what you played in the finals as well. And I crushed John in game one because I had an early Anafenza, mm-hmm. and they don't really have many main deck cards against it. But post board, they do bring in a lot of answers to try to kill it. And depending on my personal draw, if my draw is not aggressive enough, they have enough chump blockers like Visionary. They have Husk to really... there was in game three, he was able to set up a board state where he just has a Husk, but I know he has a Murderous Cut and a Vision. He has a Husk and a Visionary. I know he has a Murderous Cut in hand. My only play is a Gideon, but I can't go Gideon make a soldier because what he's going to do is cut the soldier, sack the visionary to Husk, attack Gideon for four and just kill it right mm-hmm. there. So I was in an awkward spot. I plussed one, but then he top decked a green source. I don't know why he needed, I don't remember the exact board state, but he basically was able to top deck into another visionary so that even while with Gideon at five, it was dead. And now it's even worse for me because it's dead, but the cut, the murderous cut is still in his hand. And so without an aggressive start, I felt that matchup could be tricky, especially post-board when they bring in, I'm looking at the second player place list, the one you beat. He had one murderous cut in the main, but then mm-hmm. he brings in three post-board, I think. Mm-hmm. So what are your thoughts on that particular matchup?
So I haven't played against it a ton outside of the tournament. But I played against it three times, and I beat it all three times.
What a boss.
So it could just be anecdotal, but from my perspective, it felt pretty strong. You have a main deck hate card in Anafenza, and game one, they can only stop it with Sidisi's Faithful, which you can even counter if you can kill the Faithful in response to exploit. So I think game one, they have a hard time. So you start off in a pretty good spot. And then they do have answers to Anafenza, but one, that's diluting their game plan, bringing right. removal spells. And then two, I have Disruption of my own. I'm matching their Murderous Cuts with Duress. And I'm also bringing in more removal for Jace and Nantuko Husk. And then, like you said, being aggressive is very important. And if you can be an aggressive draw with a little bit of disruption, it seems like you're favored. And mm-hmm. it's something I'd want to play more, but it feels like it's very manageable. And if you do have a problem with it, you could play Hallowed Moonlight, which I feel really gives them a hard time because it counters Rally and Collected Company. And going forward, I'm going to put one in my sideboard.
Okay. I was able to get John once when he tried to collect the company with Hallowed Moonlight.
Okay.
But I felt like at times that, but I got it, obviously, I was playing straight Manguchi list. And the awkward part for me with that card sometimes was the fact that I felt like it reminds me of another card that I've played in the past.
Okay.
Where I'm trying to play something to counter their combo, except that, like, let's say I'm playing Combust against, like, a Splinter Twin. Like, I'm trying to counter their combo. Mm-hmm. But in the Rally deck, what was annoying for me for Hallowed Burial, Hallowed Moonlight, was the fact that Rally, the Ancestors, and Collected Companies are both cards I want to counter, but they're also both instants.
Mm-hmm.
So it made me feel like I had to hold up Moonlight both on my turn and their turn.
Yeah.
So it was a little annoying that I had to hold up two every time. And that doesn't help if my draw is like a little slow, then I'm just handicapping myself by holding up two. So it's very important. I want to emphasize when you're playing against this matchup, it's super important to have some sort of aggressive draw, or at least a draw that allows you to at least land Windmate Rock, which is one of your best cards against their shit ton of ground chumpers that they have. And there's one card you have that Manguchi didn't have, and outside of Rising Miasma, and that's Painful Truths. So how was that for you?
So the card was good for me. I played against Mardu a few times and Jeskai Black, and the card is definitely strong in those matchups. It's also good against Esper Dragons. But actually going forward, I'm going to cut the card. After working on my sideboard a little more and learning about the deck from the tournament, I think that it's probably unnecessary. And basically, you have so many good cards in the main deck in every matchup that Painful Truths is sort of extra, and it was kind of making my sideboarding awkward. And I think the card's possibly just not necessary, so I would not play it. It's similar with Tassiger. Card which I used to love, but the opportunity cost makes it not worth it.
Okay. Is there any big tournaments coming up before the end of the year? There's like December is like the dead month for GPs, but are you playing anything else before 2016?
Yeah, there's actually my local shop, Great Lakes Game Emporium in Mentor, Ohio, is having a 3-year anniversary tournament. They're having like $2,500 in prizes. First place gets a foil set of Modern Masters.
What?
All right.
Yeah. Yeah, there's actually, they have a long history of giving away foil sets. I actually used to have a nickname. The other store before that one, same owner, was Foil Set, because when I was like 16 or something, I won a standard Highlander tournament for a foil set of Darksteel. And then actually 2 years ago, I won a tournament with Mono Black Devotion for a foil set of Theros, one of those. Yeah, I think it was Theros.
Okay.
I was excited about Darksteel. Not so much about Theros, but
yeah,
but it's still good.
Yeah, so I think I have a good shot at winning this foil set too, and standard. So you know what I'm playing.
You know what I'm playing, so bring it.
Yeah.
I mean, do you think you're going to be the only ringer there?
Yeah, it's capped at 80 people. It'll probably just be local people. I'm sure there'll be some good players, but I should be in good shape. Another thing about my list is I have 4 Den Protector, only 2 Heir of the Wilds. A lot of people have 3 and 3.
Okay, and you think 4 Den Protectors is for sure correct?
Yeah, 100%. It's still a two drop as well. It's not quite the same, but it's still a two drop. It still gets counters from Anafenza. It also trades with their Heir of the Wilds potentially. But Den Protector combos with other Den Protector, so I want to have as many as possible. And it's also really good after sideboard when I'm bringing in discard and removal spells. And it's just great in every matchup, and I rarely cut it. Whereas Heir of the Wilds gets cut in almost every matchup.
Hmm. Sweet. I'm having memories of when we first... It wasn't the first time we met, but it's the first time we met in a long time at where we had dinner. That was like Pro Tour Montreal.
Yeah.
Gate Crash.
That was great.
Where we had dinner with your friend Gabe, who was a vegetarian at the time. I don't know if you were just recently a vegetarian then. I would need you to refresh my memory a little.
No, yeah, I was a vegetarian then.
But not for a long time, right? Or were you just like a recent vegetarian at that point?
No, I have been for three years or so.
At that time, okay. Because what was interesting to me, it flashed back a lot of memories with you and Gabe, was like Craig Wesco replying to your win and saying, "Eat vegan food with me, immediately gain vegan superpowers."
Yeah, yeah, and on Saturday night at the tournament, Craig invited me and others to some Ethiopian restaurant. I've never had Ethiopian food.
It's good.
So it was me, it was myself, Craig Wesco, Sam Black, and then who is a vegetarian. Craig's a vegan. And then Seth Manfield came along, and he also got involved, and he had a vegetarian meal, and it was great. It's definitely an interesting experience.
I don't know how to know this fact. I just know whenever I go to GPs or PTs, and I hang around roughly the same people, whether it be Hain or I've been around Craig, and out of all the players, like when I think vegetarian Magic player or vegan, he's like at the top of my list in my head for some reason. And so it was interesting to see you bring that up. Well, him bringing that up in your thread.
Yeah, I got a lot of great support. People were excited to see my picture on the homepage.
Because it's just you with your fucking killer beard, man. and your stone cold... Well, okay, no. On DCGplayer.com, it's not a stone cold stare because you actually have a smile.
Yeah.
But your Facebook profile picture is like, yo.
Yeah, I don't know if you can see. I already made that my Skype picture just for this interview.
Yeah. Wow. So, like, I'm super, super happy for you once again. I can't say that enough. I don't have, it's not all the time where someone I've known for so long ends up crushing a very high profile tournament. So, you have no idea, man. It's, I can't wait to see you again. I don't know when you're traveling up north or when I'm traveling down south, but can't wait to see you again. Matt, do you have any more questions for Adam?
I think that's it. You seem to know way more about Stenner than I do, which is not hard, but
anything you'd like to add, Adam? Anything you want to thank, or was there any weird thing going on in the tournament? Any crazy stories outside of
I'm wondering how your Pro Tour experience was.
Oh,
and if
you want to interview me,
what your plans are competitively?
Flipping the script.
Yeah. Wow. I'm touched. You care, Adam. I love it. I was telling. It's funny. I was telling Matt how I've sort of taken a step back, sort of like you post PT Gate Crash. I've been, but. You know, a lot of times I talk to you and we just fire each other up about doing well.
Mm-hmm.
I've taken a step back because of whether it's my new job or because getting to the PT. So I made the PT twice in consecutive seasons.
Yeah.
And a lot of that passion to make it, like, I put so much emphasis on just making it. And not only that I make it, but when I played against big names, like people like Jamie Park,
yeah.
I played against them. I played against a lot of these people that people see on coverage a lot. I played against I played against people like Jamie Park. I played against Paul Cheon, Tom the Boss Ross.
Yeah.
So all these names on both of my PTs, I always felt, and even my second PT, I drafted, my first draft was in a pod with Reed Duke and Michael Jacob. Mm-hmm. And to me, I didn't feel super outclassed.
Yeah.
So I made the PT, which was a dream of mine. And to me, a large part of the motivation was to prove myself that I could hang.
Yes.
At this level. And I felt like I could. I felt like I could. Maybe I don't care if the world doesn't know it. The mm-hmm. rest of the world doesn't know it, but I know it. I know that I could hang with these boys, and that really satisfied me, fulfilled me a lot. Just achieving those PTs and making day two on both of them, and just feeling like, oh shit, you know, mm-hmm. I put these pros on a pedestal for so long, but I was so wrong to do that. I should have had more self-confidence in myself that with a little bit of hard work and dedication that I can compete and I could. On a good day, I could beat any of them. So, but the drive is going to slowly come back, I think, next year. I was telling Matt that more so than the PT, making the World Magic Cup is one of the dreams of mine that I still haven't reached yet because, of course, of all the work that I've done on manadeprived.com and stuff. People know that I bleed Canadian blood despite being Asian. Repping my country would be one of the most amazing achievements that I could possibly have.
Yeah.
I'd rather qualify for the WMC, the World Magic Cup, than a Pro Tour itself because of what it personally means to me.
Yeah.
So I'm going to drive to come back. And by playing other games, like I've been rereading like some of the chess books that I bought 10 years ago. And I've been rededicating myself into a poker a bit.
Nice.
And different concepts from those games definitely made me go back and think of Magic in a different way.
Absolutely.
And I'm with you when it comes to like coming back with different perspective, next leveling. Like
yeah.
When I was a noob, I was still dominating other players because I was just playing better net decks.
When you were a noob, you were putting your Magic experience in it. Your Magic yeah. trick experience. Oh,
my Magic trick experience. I was getting pros like you to do Magic videos with me for my little noob site at the time. And I was just dominating people because I had not more expensive cards. It's like, I just had like blue-green madness. And it wasn't necessarily expensive. It was just a way better deck than what a casual competitor uh-huh. I would bring. But now I would notice things like the reason why, let's say, like I feel like I could write a beginner's book where it's like the way you have to sort of beat control decks with counter spells is you have to take advantage of the fact that they're not necessarily spending mana on each of their turns. So if you have a huge advantage if you have, let's say, either a flash creature. Mm-hmm. Even if it's counterable, a flash creature or like a instant spell like Abzan Charm,
yeah.
Because you can pass a turn. They had a counter spell up. So they lost three mana if they have three up. And on their turn, they have to keep it up again. And if you use, you still have the opportunity to use the three that you have now. So in essence, you beat these control decks by just using your mana more effectively than them. So all these sort of higher level concepts I never fully understood until now. And of course, to construct a good control deck for them to use their mana efficiently, that's why they have cards like Anticipate and Jace's Ingenuity to fill up those holes of non-mana usage. Mm-hmm. And so that's just a little example of how I now view that game, whereas before I just play, oh, against a control deck, I just want to jam my spells without knowing like the exact reason, like the higher level reason of why it's good to do that and what angle you can use to take advantage of these control decks and what these control decks can, how they can construct their 75 so that they're more efficient. So more anticipates or Jace's Ingenuity or like different cards like that or Forbidden Alchemy or whatever they had in the past so that they could, even if they don't counter you, they just play something that increases their value. Yeah.
And that sort of touches on why Ebbs and Aggro is so great. Mm-hmm. It's so proactive and it forces the opponent to react. And it's funny you mentioned chess because I was telling some people that the way to play Ebbs and Aggro was to constantly force their hand and in theory check them. Just constantly check them, make them cast that removal spell, make you do something and make them do something, and then eventually you're able to do something that puts you farther ahead, whether that's, you know, get Gideon going or play Wingmate Rock or maybe start your Dem Protectors. But if you can force them to deal with what you're doing, they can't do anything of their own, and that keeps you in control, and that makes all your cards better. It lets you be more flexible with Dem Protector. And
I agree with that, and Warden of the First Tree allows you to do that sort of thing. It's like you have to do something or else I'm going to level this guy up on your turn. Like there's stuff like that, that the fact that you can upgrade and gain value on their turn with so many different cards like Abzan Charm, Warden of the First Tree, Dem Protector, even like you can flip it up. Stuff like that is just huge.
Lets you sculpt a game plan and lets you be flexible, lets you be on your toes, and it lets you, like, another thing from poker, you know, it lets you keep position. It lets you make your decisions after they've made their decision.
Right. So that's exactly right. That's why you want to initially be ahead so that they have to react, and then you can have a strong, and if they don't react, you can still punish them for not reacting because you have all these things to upgrade you.
And you can pick the best counterattack.
Right.
My development as a player, I've had to, and it's probably a pretty common thing where you start with like the aggressive decks where I was always a very proactive player because I always wanted to force my opponent. I just wanted to ask them constantly, do you have it? Do you have it? Oh, you do? Okay. Do you have it? Because I feel like that's always the way that I've always wanted to play. Because I don't know. I just, there's only so many resources that you can possibly have. But so having to, you know, my level ups were playing the control decks. We're playing, learning how to play Magic on a different way, to be more reactive. So, and my big level up is I think emotionally, like in my development as a player, I think that, and I don't know if you guys have experienced this, but like when I was playing at GP Madison, I was in a draft pod with Hain in day two and other players I recognized, cause I do coverage and I just am, you know, Adam, there's a good chance we've actually come into contact once in a while.
Yeah,
GP or whatever. So I'm constantly surrounded by people, but I'm like, I've noticed I'm just cold. Like I've just been like cold blooded and just like, I was not intimidated. I was sitting across, players in tense situations and just stone faced and just playing like one of the calmest games of Magic I've ever played. And I felt like that has been my level up where, and I, kind of with you have changed your focus to playing the best Magic that you can, I've actually found that removing my emotions has allowed me to not only play the best Magic and make the best decisions, but also accept the weird, crazy things that happen in a game of Magic that you just lose to. Like you don't draw your fourth land for three turns in a row and you just lose. Or, you know, just accept the variance without it upsetting me or affecting me in the games to come.
Yeah, that's huge. That's something that any of the greatest players in the game have mastered. I was just talking to some people about the book Elements of Poker. I'm sure KYT is familiar with it. And that's a book that talks about your emotional game and essentially playing your A game. If you want to be playing your A game, you have to remove that emotion.
Yeah.
And Yeah, it sounds like you're doing great, if that's how you feel.
Yeah, I just have to play more.
Did you actually level up, though? Because, like, it sounded like you just sat there and you were a Stone Cold killer. Like, were you are you suggesting that you weren't before? Like, with me, my issue was, like I always put them on a pedestal. And if it weren't for the fact that I'm friends with... I haven't played against Adam that often, but I'm friends with him. I'm friends with Hane, who I always knew.
Yeah, you always knew.
I always knew, and Adam will attest... is one of the few people that know that I knew from the very beginning that I was always secretly friends with one of the best players in the world. And the fact that I could play against him and pick his brain was one of the key reasons why I was no longer intimidated. It helped a crap ton. Whereas in stuff like chess and even Magic, like in the early beginning as Magic, if I was against someone who people said was like the nuts, I did feel fear. So it took some time for me to have that confidence. And I wondered if it was the same for you, or you just sat down and was a killer. That's what it sounded like.
I would say that it's a level up moment. It was a level up moment for me because it was kind of a culmination of things that I had been working on. So in a competitive setting. So for example, I hadn't played a GP in probably like a year and a half. So that seeing those results of, like, for example, you know, like coverage drafts, you know, regularly just sitting down across from Patrick Chapin and playing Magic, and regularly sitting across these people like Randy Buehler, who, you know, I like in my younger days, I was nerding out over, and then I just hang out with them and they're just like another player to me. That has helped me realize that they're just other players. Like, they're just like, they just happen to be good at this thing that you are also doing with them. And that doesn't mean that you should lose, or that you deserve to lose, or that you're just going to lose anyway. And I had to really, in order for me to realize that, and also realize the emotional control that I had been working on, I had to put myself in a situation where those things had to help me. So I had to put myself in a high level situation, like playing a GP. I had to do that in order to see that the culmination of those results. And that for me is why Madison is a level up. I consider it a level up moment.
Another interesting thing you said was about dealing with those extreme moments or those situations where there's just nothing you can do. And I remember last weekend at the drinking fountain, I overheard some people talking, and some kid was complaining. He's like, "Yeah, I didn't even get to play Magic that round. You know, lost to Blood Moon, and then I lost to Fairy." And he was grumbling. And I was just thinking, well, it sounds like you played Magic. That's what Magic is. Like, in my mind, that is what Magic is.
Yeah, yeah.
And really, playing the game is being able to mitigate all that and preventing that. That's the game, is dealing with those times you draw five, dealing with those times you miss your land drops or you get flooded, your opponent has a perfect draw, and being able to understand that and be mindful of that is huge.
Yeah, I've tried to even stop talking about those sort of situations, yeah, except as like brief asides. Like, if somebody asks me, "How'd your match go?" It's like, I got mana screwed, like, whatever. As just sort of like, because the more you obsess about them, like, if you talk about them and you ruminate over those things, that actually becomes what you become most concerned about.
Yeah, what you want to be talking about and ruminating over and thinking about is the mistakes that you made.
Yeah.
The bad mulligans, the bad keeps, the decisions that you made that actually affected the outcome, not the randomness.
Yes, and Adam, I'm curious. So going back to the personal reasons that you kind of have taken steps back, you don't have to really expound upon the reasons specifically, but I'm very curious for our listeners as to how, what steps you took to kind of get yourself back into a good mental state, or get over whatever it was that was preventing you from playing your best, or even going and playing. I know, for example, I've had to deal with
with like irresponsibility in terms of money and perhaps even mild addiction as sort of, you know, my journey through Magic. How about you? What are some things that you've done steps you took to change that for yourself?
Well, some of it was just getting burnt out of the game. Had been playing on the Pro Tour for the better part of 6 years. And I think that at a certain point, I basically took it for granted. Every Pro Tour, you know, is a big opportunity and a big event and a big responsibility if you want to do well. And I think that I was just, you know, I took it for granted that I was always going to Pro Tours, and I was all the time, and I did all right at them. And I think it sort of lost some of like the specialness or luster, and that I didn't, this wasn't present enough in the moment of what I was doing or where I was.
Okay.
And playing the best Magic that I was playing. And I think that sort of, I was basically losing my focus from it. And then that, like in 2011, I started off with a great start to the season. And then the second half, I floundered out. And then stepping back from the Pro Tour allowed me to sort of come back with a new perspective as to what it meant. Like another example would be like this summer, I played the TCG Invitational that I mentioned in Vegas. And it was after Grand Prix Las Vegas, and there's a lot of Magic pros in Vegas, and it was really competitive. It's a small tournament, but it was super hard. Every round, everyone played against someone who was a quality player, and so many people were talking about how it was the hardest tournament they had ever played in. And I knew that going into this tournament last weekend, that it was going to be hard, and I wasn't going to be able to just expect to win, and that I had to give myself all the advantages I could. And so that led me to Abs and Aggro, a deck that I was comfortable with. I could play it 100%. And a deck that I was going to be comfortable with every turn. I would know what to do. I wouldn't ever have any doubt in what I was doing or what the opponent was doing. And I, like, looking back at a lot of Pro Tours I played in or other tournaments, I've had poor deck selection or maybe listening too much to other people and not listening enough to my own ideas and own convictions or own thoughts about a format or a deck.
Okay.
So I definitely have been able to do that better, and that's a lot of fun. And building my own decks and tuning and just sort of realizing the fact that I have a lot of knowledge of the game and I can apply it to my benefit and benefit of people I work with.
Okay. It's you actually mentioned something that I think that other people can work on, is that identifying your own weaknesses and acknowledging your own strengths. Because I think a lot of people get themselves, like, put themselves in the way. They get too obsessed with, like, you were talking about deck choices and stuff, and making deck choices that aren't exactly optimal, or thinking that you're more clever than the Platinum Pro who writes about the format every week.
Yeah.
And, you know, I actually really think that that's a common problem I see among a lot of players, is that they just don't they think they're too clever or what have you. So it's cool that you bring that up and that you saw that as a problem within yourself, and that you were able to acknowledge your strengths as a player.
Yeah, absolutely. So before you leveled up in terms of your stone coldness and ability to contain your emotion, what was holding you back? Because definitely, like, emotions are a big part in anyone's game, and I've definitely suffered in the past from going on tilt. And whenever I do well in a tournament, it's because I am playing my best game and I am dealing with the mistakes and the losses and having a good mindset. Not expecting to win, but knowing that if I play my best, that I definitely have the ability to win, and that if things go my way, I will win. And I've definitely played matches, you know, with a negative mindset and thinking things are going to go wrong and, you know, playing scared and have lost. And I'm sure a lot of people can identify with that.
Uh-huh.
But what do you think was the biggest issue and how did you overcome that specifically?
Well, it's been twofold for me. One is a sort of meta issue that I have dealt with over the years because so I have ADHD and I wasn't I wasn't diagnosed as a child like I should have been. And so I grew up and I've, you know, gone to college and failed college and tried again. And I'm currently still finishing up my degree. But I'm in a better state because I'm partial. I'm diagnosed. I'm getting help. So impulsivity has been a huge part of the problem. I'm impulsive and inattentive, and I'm not hyperactive, which is actually a lot of how you identify people who are like obviously, oh, you're obviously ADHD because you know your friend's bouncing off the walls or whatever. I was never that kid. I was never that person. So controlling my impulses was always something that that I had trouble with, and I have worked on over the years. The second is separating the result of a game or a match of Magic from my self-worth.
Mm-hmm.
I think earlier in my Magic career, I was much more, I identified much more with being a winner because that's where the cool people were. That, you know, you wanted to hang out with the cool people because they were winning. And I didn't, you wanted to feel good about yourself. So you attached winning to feeling good about yourself. Mm-hmm. And applying worth to yourself because that's, you know, that's kind of how you get respect in this community to a certain extent is, you know, your results kind of speak for themselves, but it's much more than that. You know, I mean, the reality is that it's much more than the result of a tournament of Magic, but I had to break myself from the idea that winning or losing affected my self-worth. And I think that separation, that was one of the huge keys because then I could walk away from a match of Magic and really look at it and be, and ask myself how I could have done better. What went wrong? What went right? How did I improve? Where do I need to improve?
Yeah. Yeah. That last thing you said, you're not thinking about the result. You're thinking about how you can improve and what you did. Brad Nelson wrote an article last year, perception of perfection, that he essentially shared his process for improvement that brought him all of his success, and that he just thinks of all these tournaments combined into, you know, just one long story, and all he can do after a tournament is just think back to what did he do, what decisions could he have changed, down to his deck choice, to the in-game decisions, everything he did, and learn for next time, and just constantly improve. And it sounds like that's what you described.
Yep.
Also, interesting, you mentioned the attention deficit. I was talking with a friend this past weekend, and he was mentioning suffering from that. And you know, he's gotten self-help for that, and he's doing great. And he talked about how that affects him in Magic. And something that he has done that's helped him immensely is taking notes on his score pad and keeping track of everything that dealt damage to either player. And that helps him focus on the game, and it helps him think back on the game and develop a better picture of what's going on. And he said that's something that's really helped him. And I think that's something that other players might try to do. Players, you know, focus on the game is important for everyone, and every player loses focus at times, and anything you can do to keep yourself focused is definitely going to help, because there's much going on in a game that if you forget something, it could be devastating.
Yeah, I've had to really, and that's one thing that I've vastly improved on, is when I sit down to play you in a game of Magic, I'm going to sit down to play you in a game of Magic. Uh-huh. And this game of Magic is the only one I'm ever concerned with.
Yeah,
and I've had to, like,
concerned with the next one.
Yeah, I've had to, like, tune out judge calls that are literally right next to me. I've had to tune out, interrupt, you know, somebody yells or something, you know, people are loud, somebody drops a deck. You just have to just boom and just get back. Like, I've had to, I have some refocusing sort of techniques. They're not like super elaborate or anything, but I have like, I have constant reminders of, hey, focus on this game, focus on this game.
Another focusing technique that I was reading about on Friday, actually, so it was really fresh in my mind at the tournament, the OODA loop, observe, orient, decide, act. And it's basically a tool that you could use to take stock of any situation and determine, you know, where you're at, where you're going, what you're doing, and then how to do it.
Okay.
And I actually, I made a huge mistake in the fifth round of the tournament, or rather the fifth round of the tournament, through the first game. Basically, I used my Abzan Charm to draw some cards rather than remove a creature. I just didn't see myself under the pressure that I was actually under and just quickly died. And so I kept that in mind. And then throughout the tournament, there was a couple situations where I thought of this, and it helped ground me in the game. And yeah, I'm sure. So definitely.
That's actually a funny mode I've gotten myself out of over the years is, learning how to play when you're on your back foot. Cause I always felt like I was a player that was right click attack all.
Uh-huh.
And just, you know, when in doubt, swing them out. So, but yeah, you can't win games. You can't win a lot of games of Magic with that strategy. So,
yeah, with the Tarka Rad these days, you can.
Well, sure. Yeah. So that's what I got.
Man, Adam, you've added, he interviewed both of us, Matthew. but that's about all the time we've got for this episode. And, you know, if our listeners have level up stories, we'd love to see them in the comments, as well as things that you can learn from other games, as Adam sort of alluded to with the poker book he referenced, Elements of Poker by Tommy Angelo. And there's a lot of, the reason I look towards other games like chess and poker and not Magic is because there's just a shit ton more literature in these other games.
Oh yeah.
And so you can read, there's like, in Magic, there's like Next Level Magic by Chapin, and Flores has Decade, the collection of his articles, but there's nothing that's really, it's nowhere near the same. And Magic is like super, has so much depth to it, but these other games, there's just certain concepts that are just explored more, and you'll be surprised that some of them do, you'll find a link somewhere to from poker to Magic, from chess to Magic, and then if you can put the links together, you can discover something that, you know, might surprise you, which is what happened to me. It made me look at Magic in a more analytical way, made me see like mana efficiency in a very different way than I used to. And so I'm where I am now just because of a lot of different perspectives that I got from playing other games. So
here's actually one suggestion I have right next to my podcasting desk, which when you're a baller like me, that you have like a desk for podcasting, you have a desk for reading, you have a desk for working. Right next to me is my board game shelf, and I'm looking over at Seven Wonders, which I don't know if either of you have played Seven Wonders.
I have it. I own it.
Yes.
I have not.
I would recommend it, highly recommend it, for any Magic players. Mainly because it teaches you how to, it doesn't teach you, but it reinforces drafting techniques. Because basically the whole concept is that it's basically a draft. Because seven card hands where you draft a card going to, you know, you draft out of a pack that's going to the left, and then you draft out of a second pack that's going to the right, and then you do another pack that's going to the left. And it's basically just a game that's based on drafting. So you have to You have to do a lot of the things that you have to do in a regular draft, which is understand what's going to be passed to you, understand where your like strategies are going, understanding because the information that you have the information about what other players are doing, so you can actually start to figure out who's going to take what and why and when, so you can start planning your picks. So I always recommend Seven Wonders as a game for Magic players that they may love that they haven't already played.
That sounds great.
Sweet. I'm going to have to play it more.
Yeah. And, yeah.
With that, I mean, I feel like we can do another episode.
Contest actually. Time. Yeah. Oh yeah. I totally agree. We should do like, I'm going to totally steal your thunder here, KYT, but I think we should totally do an episode all about, transferable skills.
Yeah. I feel another contest time. Okay. Let's wrap it up with that before Kyle kills me.
So, we had, 7 comments this time. So I had to break out a D8 as opposed to a D6, which is very good. I'm hoping that we get to a D10 and then maybe a D12 and then maybe a D20. So, our first commenter was Millward. Second commenter was Dane Coates. Third contenter was commenter was Moses. Fourth was Lord Frezen. Fifth was Eric with a CH. Sixth is Max Roche. He is looking forward to winning this one. Josh Millard was the next one. And I think that's it. Mandrew has commented with hashtag more Mendoza, which I fully support. So here we go. I'm going to roll my little die. Commenter number 5. So 1, 2, 3, 4. And Eric. Eric is the next winner of a playmat. Hit me up at kyt@manadeprived.com.
Yeah, hit him up at kyt@manadeprived.com.
Yeah, send KYT your mailing info and you win a random GP playmat.
Sick.
So yeah, and then my contest for this week, for next week, I should say, I'm pulling contests off the shelf, guys. I told you I have a shelf of them. I decided to write a riddle. Now, I wrote this in 10 minutes, so forgive me that it is bad, but it's kind of clever. But here you go. I'm going to read the riddle, and your job is to, if you guess the card in the comment section, and on next week's episode, we'll pick a winner. And yeah, send you another playmat. So here we go. Are you ready, KYT?
Ready.
Okay. I'm a one and oldie, but I'm not black nor goldie. And I'm coldie. Never rapping, always tapping. For a little mana, I've stopped attacking. What am I? So with that, if you think you know what it is, let us know in the comments.
Not bad, not bad.
Actually just make good guesses. I'll probably honor good guesses.
Whoa, what a generous guy. And with that, we are out. And please, hashtag more Mendoza if you want to keep the content on the show. And I'm a full supporter of the more Mendoza train. So keep those more Mendozas coming. And we will see you, at least me and Matt, I think, next week. So thanks again, Adam. And we'll see you all next week.
Thanks, guys.
Bye.